Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Spellman, and welcome to What Women Must Know, a show exploring topics and subjects that really allow you to have a greater insight, depth of awareness, and certainly empowering you so you can make more informed decisions in your life. And as always, it's a great opportunity to keep learning, keep expanding, and keep becoming a more aware person. And we have a great show today. I want to first of all say, if you have just joined this show, I invite you to go to my website, whatwomenmustknow.com, because this is a website that is just filled with fantastic educational information. Many of my articles, you actually will receive two special reports when you opt in there, and that's the purpose of what I'm doing, and the purpose of the site is to give you some great information regarding all aspects of women's health and well-being. And my Facebook page is another place that I would invite you to go to, because over at What Women Must Know, you will be getting daily posts of great information, recipes, breaking news, studies, strategies, practical tools to really support you in staying healthy, staying aware, staying hormonally balanced, all the important things that really make a huge difference in our lives. And we're going to be talking about more things that help to make a huge difference in our lives. And today we're exploring some of the keys to creating emotional health and well-being. As a psychotherapist for many years, before I went on and became a naturopathic doctor, I really had a fascination with the tools to help people transform, evolve, expand, how to use the situations that are going on in their life for growth and to benefit from them. Well, today's guest is a leading thinker. Let me just tell you about him. He is David Bedrick. He is a counselor, an attorney, a teacher, an author. He spent 8 years teaching psychology and philosophy on the faculty at the University of Phoenix and taught in the Navy at 3M, the American Society of Training and Development, the Process Work Institute, psychological associations, and small groups focusing on personal growth. He received notable awards for teaching, employee development, and legal services to the community. He is a sought-after expert on the topics of shame, personal and collective trauma, cultural identity issues, stereotyping, and more. He blogs for Psychology Today and other online publications. He counsels people across the nation via phone and Skype. And he has just released a new book called Talking Back to Dr. Phil, Alternatives to Mainstream Psychology. And it's a pleasure having David Bedrick with us today. Hello, David.
Hi there. That's quite a welcome. Thank you so much.
Well, you deserve it. You're really out there on the leading edge of supporting people in the work you're doing with psychology. You know, I angled the topic for today's show, Keys for Emotional Healing, because I think that really is the greatest need we have, and that's really what you're doing. And you have your own perspective, which I happen to really resonate with, David. And as I said earlier, I've been a psychotherapist for about 10 years and kind of integrate psychotherapy and naturopathy, natural healing, and lots of other things along the way. And they all work so well together, actually. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I've never been happy with the old models of psychotherapy, mm-hmm. and I know you are forging your own pioneering path into these new models as well. So let's start with having you share some of your thoughts of where you think we need to go in terms of the tools that will help us move through the challenges of life in a way that really is empowering and supportive.
Well, that's a great question and a big question. The reason why I wrote a book and started thinking about what I call love-based psychology is that much of what psychology does meaning much of what we do to ourselves psychologically. When we have things that bug us, right, whether that's a physical symptom or feelings or a depression or a behavioral pattern, we often look at ourselves with an attitude that says something like, what's wrong with me? Or Dr. Phil would say, is that working for you? Is eating ice cream working for you? Right? Is smoking that cigarette working for you? If it's not, why not just stop doing it? Were it so easy, right?
Right, exactly.
The problem is that almost never works, and we can talk about that as we go, but also leaves people feeling ashamed. What, something really is wrong with me. That's why I get into relationships with these kinds of people. That's why I eat ice cream. That's why I'm depressed. And that attitude of something is wrong with me tends to hurt people. It turns them against themselves. And rather than, as you were implying, using situations for growth, seeing what kind of seeds are in those difficulties, we sort of try to root parts of ourselves out. And those parts usually don't go along with our agenda so quickly.
Right. And why do you think that the first, you know, the first thoughts we have when something isn't going the way we anticipated are thoughts that either chastise ourselves or bring shame to ourselves? There's so many choices of how we could perceive a circumstance and the events that are occurring. But why is it that we, in general terms, I would say, go for the negative?
Yeah. I mean, the first answer I have to say is I don't really know the answer. But I've witnessed a lot and seen a lot, and I have thoughts about it. The main thought is that it is as prevalent as you're suggesting. Our inner criticism, as it were, is so potent. I just read an article recently that said 97% of women are cruel to themselves around their bodies. Right? Cruel, not just sort of like, hey, I would like to lose a few pounds. And this is just true in so many areas. Maybe it's a paradigm that we've been used to for so long that looks at ourselves critically. Certainly, many of us grown up in homes where criticism is the way. You could say that discipline, rather than following an idea of discipleship, has become punishment for many people. So I think those are some of the reasons. We also have, as you know, as a person who's practicing alternative medicine, we also have a medical model that many of us have learned. That means if there's something going on, right, if there's some bump on my hand, something's wrong and I should do something about it. And if it's an infection, I should get rid of it. So, which sometimes is a really good idea, right? I like getting rid of infections. But that notion of attacking something, rooting it out, is also sort of part of the paradigm of how we live and look at many things. So I guess we end up turning that on ourselves. Oh, I'm acting strange. I'm nervous. I'm angry. I'm whatever. I ought to not be that way. Let me see if I can root it out, as opposed to maybe in an alternative medical model, we could say offering a homeopathic dose. Maybe there's something in that nervousness, in that anger. There's a seed, there's a germ, an essence in there that really might be needed, and something might need to support me in that somehow to resonate with that for my healing.
So can you share a little bit about what that focus of love-based psychology, as you like to call it, how does that differ from more traditional approaches to psychotherapeutic models?
Right. A love-based psychology does a number of things different. One of them is, instead of having a model of what health is, you ought to be balanced, you ought to be not nervous, you ought to be not down, you ought to be up and productive, right? Those are common models, norms for health. Instead of having a norm for health, a love-based psychology says, you are an individual. There's a diversity of kinds of people, whether that's because of their color or their genders or just the kind of individual they are. So rather than trying to normalize a person, I think that's an interesting person over there. I wonder what kind of person they are. I'm not trying to fit them into something. So if a person, let's say, is more down, they say, I'm depressed a lot, then I would think, in their mind, according to some norm, they ought to be up and productive. Maybe they ought to be. I don't know. But I wouldn't assume that. I would assume that they don't know how to get along with being down yet. Now, that's an easy thing to say. Many people suffer quite a bit. But going down with that person, I might find something really interesting about them. I just talked to a woman recently who said that she was depressed, and I asked her what her depression was like. I don't know that anybody's ever asked her that question. What's it like for you to be depressed? People just think, oh, you're depressed, that's bad, I feel sorry for you, or here's some medicine, or how can we get you up and going again? Mm-hmm. That's the normalizing function. So from a love-based psychology, I say, tell me what it's like for you to be depressed. And her head goes down a little bit, and she looks down. I say, your head goes down a little bit, and you look down. She said, yes, I feel almost sometimes like I don't want to live. And I say, tell me about not wanting to live. And then she said, deep down, I want to live with God, not here. And I said, tell me about living with God. And then she started telling me for a while about the depth of her spiritual life and how she doesn't get time in her regular life for that. So in a way then, what I found was by following her depression downward rather than anti-depressing her, as it were, I found that she has a profound spiritual life. She wants to be more with God, in her language. That means for her doing certain practices that become before all of her tasks during the day. In some way, her depression says, I don't want to live the life I am living. I want to live a more spiritually oriented life. I wouldn't have found that out if I tried to help her get going again. She would have just started going back to her usual tasks. So that love approach says, I wonder if there's something beautiful and wonderful in what this person's finding problematic. Can I discover what that is with the person?
You know, that it's really fascinating, and the experiences that people are having at any moment in their life's journey is fascinating because it's all grist for our mill if we know how to use it and work with it and have a context in which to grow from it. And I think that's what we miss, isn't it? We're not taught how to use what's going on in our life for growth. We're always struggling to get out of where we are at.
That's right. That's right. And there's very, just as I exampled with this woman, there's not much modeling of inquiry about experience. So what I mean by that, so if a person says they're a smoker, then many of us would say that's not good. Well, most of us know that, right? The mm-hmm. side of the package of the cigarette says that. Most of us know the person who's coming to me for the smoking problem, they know smoking is bad. So they don't need one more person telling them it's a bad thing, right? Smoking is bad, stop that. Well, they don't need psychological counseling to help them say that. They don't need a Dr. Phil type person to say, it's not working for you, stop smoking, right? They already know that. So the only question left is how can we help them? What is the smoking about? But the very first experience that I think is important in that situation is to say, tell me what it's like for you to smoke. That person is unlikely to have ever been asked that question. Mm-hmm. They'll say, well, it gives me comfort. But I'll tell you something, I've never seen that true. Mm-hmm. When you ask people, well, tell me what it's like for you to smoke, well, it makes me comfortable. I understand it, but make believe there's a cigarette in your mouth. I might give that person a pen. Right? And say, put that pen between your fingers and draw on it like you would a cigarette. And they might, I'm thinking of a particular person now, that person inhales from my imaginary cigarette and they lean back and they look up at the ceiling of my room. And I say, what are you looking at? And they say, I'm just looking up at the sky. I say, tell me about it. And they say, the world is so incredible. How come I'm getting involved with this problem or that problem? And right in there, they have a whole reflective attitude. So in a sense, they're not looking for comfort. That person that I'm talking about is looking for reflection. And the reason I found that out is because I asked them the very simplest of questions. What's it like for you to be a smoker, to be eating ice cream, to be obsessed with the doorknobs and germs? What is it like for you? It's a very human question. That's a very simple question, but people have never been asked it. They've never been asked to inquire of their own basic experiences.
So it's like having a relationship with another person from a place of being infinitely curious about who they are.
Beautifully said.
Right? I guess that full stop right there.
Yeah, I love that phrase. I want to borrow it from you. I'll quote you. Infinitely curious. Curiosity is such an alternate, in a way, I think it's part of a loving attitude. It's an alternate to what's wrong with me, that's screwed up, how come you can't stop that? You must be eating ice cream because you're not disciplined, you know? Otherwise, you would have followed that diet program, even though the statistics say diet programs don't work. They work for 5 to 10% of the people at most. right? We know that $60 billion industry, diet industry, $60 billion, 5 to 10% of the people get helped in any sustainable way. Yet people keep on doing it because they can't look at themselves in what you're saying, an infinitely curious way. I wonder what I'm doing with this ice cream. It's an amazing thing. I can think of so many different stories. Ice cream. For some reason, I have ice cream on my mind, probably because I just talked to somebody who loved. I asked her what she ate when she felt upset or tense, and she ate salt caramel ice cream. I love people have very specifics. And I say, what's it like to eat that salt caramel ice cream? Well, it just helps me relax. Lots of people have theories that aren't really consistent with what happens. I said, imagine you're putting it into your mouth. And they said, oh, my, it makes my heart sing, she says to me. I said, can you make the song? She says, it's like a note. I said, sing the note. And she said, I've only heard it from nuns in a church that I go to where you can't see them. You just hear them singing. I said, listen to that note. Let's see if you can make it. She was shy to make it. So I started going, oh, you know, trying to to make her feel comfortable. We started doing this note. And she said, it's like a pure expression of the heart. What is she doing with that ice cream? She's getting in touch with some pure expression that's in her that wants to come out. The ice cream reminds her it's a little taste of something that's in her heart. That's what it connects her up with. She would not have known that unless I had asked her, tell me about eating the ice cream. But then when she makes that note, her face lights up and her eyes get moist. She looks incredible. She looks like a totally different person than what would be called a tense person. She's found an answer. It's the nun's voice in her, as it were, is what she finds in her ice cream.
So how does that then transform her choices, or does it?
Mm-hmm. Well, it does it in a number of ways. The first thing, in my mind, is to be true to what is coming up in that person. So if she hears a nun's voice, let's say this person, it has a heart expression in it. She says it's a pure expression of the heart. At that point, I will say to her, tell me about, she says, I would like to stop, you know, drinking sodas, she, one of the things she said. I said, can you feel that heart note, that heart, pure heart of yourself? And she says, yes, and she feels shy. Can you feel that heart expression? Yeah. Tell me about drinking soda. Do you think it's time to stop? She says, I'm not sure. It could be too harsh on me to stop right now. I say, don't stop right now then. Now, many people would say, what are you talking about? She thinks she can do that. But I would follow her heart expression. And as soon as I tell her that, she says, that's so interesting. I said, watch. She says, I don't really know if I care about them the soda anymore. It's ironic. Well, we all know that, right? It's ironic in that way. But somehow I'm believing that her heart's expression has an answer to it because she's looking for it. And the heart has a way of going about it. And her heart says, don't fight with the soda too much. And that's the way to let go of it. I would not have known that. Mm-hmm. But her heart did, and I accessed that heart. So what happens then is it's as if it depotentiates, if we can say it, the habit, meaning that her desire for soda gets less, significantly less, as she begins to feel that closer to her own heart, and she'll start doing other things. It'll start dropping off, and at some point she'll say, I don't think I want to do this anymore. What do you think? And I'll say, knock it off. But I won't start with that fight. I won't start that knock off the what you're doing until her system is in that spot and saying, that's my next step. It's a healing path that she's showing me that's hers, and I'm going to be religiously follow it, not my idea about where we should get her.
So when I hear you talk about this this stance that you have, this context that you work with, it's just sounds so much like a loving kindness, like a very a Buddhist approach of just being with people and allowing them to be who they are, and then by asking those questions that allow you to learn more about them, their own process allows transformation and change to happen, just because you're holding that space of total acceptance, non-judgment.
Well said. You may have said what I'm trying to describe as love-based psychology better than I can. It's that holding that loving space, having that curiosity, following that other person, knowing that they have it in them. And they're not necessarily conscious of it yet, right? They can't necessarily say right off what should you do about it, because they'll tend to echo back things that they've heard, which are usually criticisms. Well, I'm needing comfort. I'm self-medicating. I'm, you know, whatever. I'm undisciplined. People will parrot back whatever they've been told their whole lives. But if we truly follow them with that kind of loving, accepting awareness, people have an amazing amount of intelligence and wisdom about themselves. It's almost like we're getting in touch with the wisdom in them, the teacher in them. So if somebody says they trust me, I think, that's okay for a little while, but I'm trusting them, not me.
Right. And, you know, what I call the old paradigm or the dominant paradigm, which probably is what it is of addressing problems and searching help, is always trying to fix people's problems, fix them up, take them, and they come in to be fixed up, which I understand, but it's like analyzing, and it's almost as though the intellectual part is in play here. But what I have learned, and I'd be interested in your thoughts, change never happens from the intellect. Change happens from another place within us. And that's what you're talking about as I hear it from love-based psychotherapy that you're doing.
Nicely said. Yeah, that's why maybe it's, to me it seems ironic sometimes. Why are you going to tell a person it's okay to do something, right? And many of us understand that, right? If I push against you, if you were standing next to me and I said, put up your hands, and I pushed against you, there's a good chance you would push back. It's not everybody would do that, but many people would do that, and at many times in people's lives they would do that. It's almost a natural response. So if we're creating a big force on somebody, there's a good chance they're going to push back on that force. It's a counterintuitive thing, but I think it's an important deeper healing thing, or psychological thing, if you will. So psychology for a long time called people who wouldn't go along with the therapist program resistant. That person's resistant, and we had to overcome their resistance. And I think that's like often a really not a good strategy.
Yeah.
If someone is resisting me more than once or twice, if I try three suggestions and the person says no three times or 30 times or whatever it is, I think they have some resistance in them. Resistance could be a good thing. I might say to them, I might look at them and say, you don't only agree with some of the ideas I have. And they might say, no, I agree. That's a person who's too agreeable. They need more resistance. They're saying they're trying to make believe they're an agreeable person, but actually what they would love to say is no. I'd say, what kind of things in your life do you go along with that you really would rather not? Well, you know, in my life, you can't really say no to your boss. You can't say no to your kids because you have to do the things that they need. And I say, you don't really feel like you can say no almost anywhere. That person is needing a little bit of that resistance. They're showing me resistance. You could say their system is saying, please believe in, love, hold a space for the resistance in me. Everyone's sort of getting rid of that, including me. And yet I'm becoming an accommodating mush in my life. At least I can come here and say no to you, right? I think,
right.
Amen.
Yeah.
That is the cure. Doing what I said is not the cure. Going against me is the cure for that particular person. Many people need that. And it's a fine process to come for.
So here's my question to you. Not everyone can afford to go to a therapist. Not everyone can find a therapist like you, who operates from this perspective, this paradigm, this love psychology. Mm-hmm. What would you offer people as some strategies to support themselves in the process of addressing issues that are creating stress within them?
Mm-hmm. I would think of a couple of things that I think help most people. First is, if there's something that you are unhappy about with yourself, regardless of what that is, it's depression, it's a sensitivity, it's a eating, it's an addiction. The first thing I would say is, see if you can become aware of your criticism that you have about that part of yourself. I'm weak. I'm no good. I'm unworthy. I'm stupid. I can't get it together. Whatever, See if you can get in touch with that. And if you can, respond to it. If somebody said that to you, you're a weak, good for nothing, what would you say back if you had a little bit of oomph in you? If you had a good friend who was standing next to you who really loved you, what would they say back? And the reason I'm saying that is because what we were saying at the beginning of the show, there's so much programmed inner criticism towards ourselves. And we often believe that that's criticism is on our side. That's what's going to help me lose weight. That's what's going to help me speak up to someone. That's going to help me do whatever. And because it rarely does, and if it's been around for more than 3 weeks, 3 years, three decades, then we should assume it's not going to work. Identifying that and learning to speak back to it is a self-empowering act, a self-loving act. Even just that little exercise. Find out what you're saying to yourself, say it out loud, and then say something back. Well, who is that? Is that like my father? Is that like a patriarchal culture? Is that like a teacher I once had? Just getting some awareness about that inner critical dynamic can soften the problem, and sometimes the problem will then may have a little bit of room or space, as you say, to find its way.
Which is such a great observation to have of oneself. You know, change begins with being able to observe one's thoughts or feelings rather than to get locked into them and react from them all the time. I know it's certainly been true for me, having had lots of therapy in my life, having right. had, you know, periods of my life that were creating tremendous amount of stress and distress and pain, which is the human experience, really. I don't think anybody just dances through life. That doesn't seem to me to be what life is really offering us, unless we're just totally oblivious or blessed. I don't know, one or the other. But it's really learning more inner resources so we can choose to perceive ourselves or observe ourselves or have different angles in which to understand our choices and our behaviors, and then learn that we have a variety of options there, not just one repetitive way of responding. At least that's been a really important process for me to discover personally.
Yeah. Yeah, we have a common interest, I think, in what I would call, I think you would call awareness of some kind. As awareness meaning, maybe awareness in some ways, I think you might agree also, and love go together. Awareness not a critical one, but one that can make, as you say, make a space, maybe with a kind of curiosity for what's happening. In that way, when I work with people, I'm meditating with them. I'm using my awareness of what's happening for them, thinking that something is going to unfold itself, right? And sometimes that first step is to loosen up the criticism that wraps around it so we can actually get to something often deeper about those problems.
Right. Yeah, how wonderful. You know, this is a good place for us to take a bit of a station break, so I'd like everyone to just take a breath. Meditate, just kind of observe your emotions, and we're going to be returning with David Bedrick, author of Talking Back to Dr. Phil, Alternatives to Mainstream Psychology, in just a minute. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and you are listening to What Women Must Know. Hi, everyone. Welcome back. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You are listening to What Women Must Know. And today we're having a wonderful conversation with David Bedrick, who is a counselor, attorney, teacher, and author. And he has spent 8 years teaching psychology and philosophy on the faculty of the University of Phoenix and has taught businesses and is now the author of the book, talking back to Dr. Phil, Alternatives to Mainstream Psychology. And I gather your title, I'm sure, has created a lot of intrigue, David. No doubt you've got a lot of attention because of your choice of mm-hmm. the title of your book. But let me just ask you, what's the real message there? Tell me about the title of your book, David.
I'm seeing the cover. I wish your audience could see the cover. It's got a top of a bald male head, like a Dr. Phil head, only, although it's not actually his because I couldn't use actually his head. But anyway, I smile
a
when,
close
when
replica.
I saw the yeah, when I saw the artist.
Lots to choose
it.
From.
Exactly. I think years ago I was trying to write a book on shame actually, and it was one of those books I had been writing for like 5 years and couldn't stop. And like, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And I would, during the middle of my day, I would get on one of these elliptical things. I would do my exercise workout, and I'd pop the TV on for my break, and I'd be on my elliptical, and then I'd flip the channels, and then I got caught by interested in watching Dr. Phil shows, and I used to talk back to the TV. Don't say that to that person. Oh my gosh, you know, I would have these dialogues. And one day when I asked myself about finishing my book, I realized that what was happening is that I was spending more time talking back to Dr. Phil, so to speak. and a friend of mine said, maybe you should write that book. Well, anyway. But the essential message of the book is to not look at ourselves, and I've been saying only critically. Dr. Phil says, how is that working for you? Again, as if somebody could say, that pattern doesn't work for me, and therefore I would change it. And it just doesn't give us that kind of loving awareness, open, curious look to what people are made of. And it acts like change is different than it is most of the time. You were implying something about this a minute ago. That I find that what changes in people, let's say a person comes and says, this is my problem, I'm angry, I have anger problems, they may say. I can think of a number of people who I work with who would say that. And then I think, what is this anger problem that they're having? What are they describing? And often their viewpoint of it is not so good. And when the viewpoint of it changes, often the anger changes. So when they come in, they think, I want my anger to lessen. Could you make my anger go away? More or less, right? Can you give me anti-anger medicine? And I think that's what they're looking for. But what they end up getting most of the time, particularly if it's a longer-term problem, is a different viewpoint, a different attitude, a different awareness towards that thing. In this case, the anger. And then mysteriously, once the anger is looked at differently, it starts to find its own way of being powerful in certain situations or peaceful in other situations. So I think what happens is a lot of times people come for help saying, could you make this thing not happen for me? Could you change this pattern? And what changes in them is their way of understanding themselves, the way of viewing themselves. And I think often it's a more accepting, loving understanding. And somehow that loving understanding gives a healing and a change to the thing they wanted to help more than going directly at it. It's counterintuitive, but that's often what helps us, what helps people, especially if the problem is long-term. If a person says, yeah, I've been struggling with weight loss for 40 years, dieting and not dieting and dieting and not dieting, can you show me how to lose weight? I think they've been trying that for 40 years. Let's not go after the weight problem directly. Let's talk about how they think about their bodies, how they think about food, why they would want to lose weight, whatever. Things about how they think about themselves. And they might sort of come to a different understanding of those patterns. And then, strangely enough, those patterns might loosen up, make me much more amenable to fitting with the lifestyle that the person actually wants.
Because that's really the greater purpose behind a problem is to go deeper into a more profound understanding of what the dynamic is, what really are the needs, it's a way to search oneself, to get into a deeper relationship with oneself than we have before. And as we do that, then it opens the door for new things to emerge, and that includes new behaviors.
Right. People are so, I know not everybody thinks this, and people can think of alternate examples. I think people are just absolutely amazing and incredible. Mm-hmm. And I'm never I'm always surprised when I sit down with someone who says they have some difficulty. I'm always surprised by what ends up coming out of it. Something flowers that neither they nor I would have expected. And I'm just amazed. I'm thinking of a woman I wrote about in my book. I have a chapter on obsessions, who came to me because she had a difficulty. Her difficulty was that she liked to get undressed in front of people. And so she would find places, sometimes go to hot tubs or whatever, that she can get undressed in front of people. So this was rather disturbing, right? Seemingly causing difficulties. And lots of men then sort of got interested in her that she didn't want interested in her, right? And then somebody, a Dr. Phil kind of person, could say, well, if you wouldn't get undressed in front of people, maybe these men wouldn't be calling you, right? Great. Well, I think that's true, right? let's take that. But let's also look at the fact that she's been doing it for a lot of years and it's not stopping. So
yeah.
One more person telling her that.
Yeah.
And I remember I wasn't sure what to do with her. And I went to my supervisor at the time, a man named Arnie Lindell, and I said, Arnie, can you help me with this client? I don't know how to help them. And she said, what's her problem? I said, she likes getting undressed in front of people, and then it creates difficulties in her life and men getting interested in her she doesn't want to be with. And he said, tell me a little bit more about her. Describe her. And I described a very closed person, a very closed-up person who didn't talk about anything other than this particular pattern, which I didn't miss. And he said, oh, she's a really closed person. He said, she needs to get naked. I said, what do you mean she needs to get naked? Right? That's a crazy idea. And he said, next time you're with her, tell her to get really naked and start telling you what's inside of her. Show you what her feelings are and her deeper experiences are. She doesn't know how to talk about herself at all. And I went to her, and I didn't use the get naked phrase because that was Arnie's way of kind of giving me the symbology of it. And I said, tell me more about what it's like to be you and your experiences and your feelings. And she became so shy, she covered up, you could say. She naturally covered up and then got shy, and she said, I don't really have many friends. I don't know how to make friends to tell people who I am. So in a sense, her system developed only one way of opening, for whatever reason. Now we could talk about what the reason is, but in a big way, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
She needed to learn how to close up, put clothes on, so to speak, and then open herself slowly. And as she began to do that, she got less interested in taking her real clothes off too quickly.
So it's like a symbol. Our behaviors are often symbolic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
We're also creative, too, how we do things we do.
Our psyches are infinitely creative.
Yeah.
They will work out a way of expressing something. They will develop complex rituals, right?
Yeah.
Smoking rituals. Oh, my gosh. I worked with a guy who is a marijuana smoker. He was and he wanted to stop smoking, and he couldn't. And he would consider himself a good Christian. And this in his spiritual life and his Christian life was very, very important to him. And I said, tell me about smoking marijuana. And, of course, he had his usual judgments. It's no good. It's bad. I shouldn't do it. It's a sin. I should, you know, Jesus says I shouldn't do this, whatever. He had his whole story about it. And I'm like, okay, great. That's your point of view. But what's it like? Do you smoke marijuana alone? He goes, no, I always smoke with a few of my friends. I said, tell me what it's like to smoke with them. And anyway, and after a few minutes, he could describe. He said, I like this marijuana cigarette, this joint. I said, yeah, and then what happens? And he said, and then when I light the lighter, I see this little glow. I said, tell me about the glow. He said, it lights up my friends' faces. And then he got teary. I said, what's happening? He goes, I love these people so much. They're my community. Right there in his ritual of smoking, he's making a communitas, a community, that he didn't feel as much actually sitting in the pews. He didn't need, you could say, the substance to affect his state. That's another question. But he created a ritual where he saw a glow in the community experience of being with his friends. This was so touching for him. Maybe he should have sit more with candles. We talked about lighting candles with his friends and things like this, you know, making it, connecting it with his religious belief system.
Did it change his behavior?
Yeah, it changed his behavior. He became less interested in smoking the marijuana. So
yeah, interesting. So I want your thoughts on our cultural context of how we deal with emotions and emotions that are distressing or disturbing, or you know, whether it's depression, anxiety. I mean, we are medicating an entire population for whatever emotion may cause some discomfort in people. you know, the Prozacs, the Valium, the Xanax, the you know, we're putting women with this created condition called PMDD, premenstrual dysphoric disorder, which I can tell you the whole story of how that was, you know, fabricated condition to sell more Prozac. So what are your thoughts? What are your concerns? What do you want people to know about the medication or the use of pharmaceutical drugs to medicate emotional states?
I'm still with your statement about the PMDD. These things I just say, ouch. Something inside is like, oi. My Jewish accent's coming, oi. You know? It's like,
it's so cute.
One more diagnosis, I mean, for whatever, for what might be a relatively, for some people we can argue about it, but which are growing natural processes in some way. It's just painful, so I just want to echo that sentiment with you. It's difficult. I think there's different levels. I think for the individual and the culture at large, I would have a different message. If an individual came to me and said, I'm depressed, I'm taking antidepressants, should I stop? I would not think they should or shouldn't yet. I wouldn't use my cultural analysis in that moment. I would have to listen to that person. And if they said, I feel so bad, and this is about the only thing that's helping me, I would never at that moment suggest, why don't you try stopping? Because it's an individual now, and my own heart has to follow them. They might be reaching out for something they need. I don't know for how long. But on the cultural level, which is where your question is, it's a travesty. I can't remember the last statistic I looked at for ADHD. They were saying like 15 to 20% of the kids ought to be diagnosed. You know, I mean, and I'm thinking, this can't be right. And in the black and brown areas, neighborhoods, the children of color, it's even more likely. So in a lot of ways, then at the cultural level, it's being used, one, to control certain people. Let's put them in a space that makes it easier for me to teach them, or easier for this person to go to work, or easier for this woman to do the dishes in her house, or whatever. There's lots of ways people are using that to normalize themselves into a state that's rather difficult and rather painful, and often very counterproductive. Now, again, the individuals, any individuals listening who's taking some substance, they should carefully consider that with their doctor, with themselves, with friends, people who love them, whether they want to get off that or not. But culturally, it's a huge pharmaceutical industry. I think when I first started looking into it some years ago, I don't know if this is still true, the largest selling drug on the planet was Viagra.
Right.
It's the largest selling drug on the planet. In fact, the Great Britain's healthcare system had to say no to people getting it, or it would bust their healthcare system. So you think, like, people are constantly controlling their responses, their reactions, their feelings all the time to make them into something they think they ought to be without going very deep into it. Anyway, we could say more about how to deal with feelings, but I don't want to stop there for just a second and see what you wanted to say next.
Well, I really enjoy having this conversation with you about things that are fascinating to me. Where do I want to, you know, the comment I would like to make and have your thoughts about it. When I was doing my psychotherapy, I was also very involved with alternative approaches. Mm-hmm. I've always been interested in healing anyway, and I would sit down, have a long questionnaire, and hear people's comments, learn about their diet, you know, what they were involved, just a whole big story, and I would often send them off to either get a chiropractic treatment or acupuncture, or maybe see a naturopath, because I would see some of their emotional conditions, some of their heightened emotional upsets could be symptoms of physiological imbalances or nutritional deficiencies or whatever. So I would send them off. They would follow up, do the treatments, whatever, come back, be much more in balance, and were able to be much more successful in attaining their goals in the therapy setting with me. Mm. Because they were in a more balanced state. They weren't so, you know, just swinging so wildly out of harmony with themselves. And so the thought I have for you is, and I'm just kind of rhetorical more than anything else, is wouldn't it be interesting if somehow there could be more of an integration between psychotherapy tools and integrative medicine tools, so we can work with the person more as the whole? Because if we talk about depression, and, you know, I suffered from anxiety for a year. I would wake up with anxiety. I went to therapists. I was still a therapist at that point. I went to the best therapists I knew. No one could resolve the anxiety, right? And then I discovered I was having anxiety attacks every morning at 3 a.m. because I had severe adrenal exhaustion, and it's a classical symptom of adrenal dysfunction. 3 a.m. wake up for a variety of reasons of the physiology. So that was a huge wake-up call for me. And that's just a little vision I hold of how we, in these modalities, can be so much more effective when we can integrate some of these different approaches of mind, body, and spirit together in supporting a person on their journey to greater balance and wholeness, which to me is the ultimate journey that we're all on anyway.
Well, I love that you're doing
your comments about that.
First, I want to say thanks for doing that work and for doing the work of studying multiple schools of thought and practices and professions in terms of medicine, psychology, and other things that I don't know as much about you, but you apparently have studied in spiritual areas. I just want to say I appreciate that. We need folks like you who are putting their feet into those multiple areas, even if they don't practice in all of them, because then they have a sense of that integration possibility, how they blend together. So if we keep people at only one profession, that's good if that's their passion and love, but then they may not have that broader perspective that you have from having put your feet in multiple pools. I'm sorry, pools and ponds are coming up in my mind. Sorry about that. But it's a wonderful thing to see that. Some people know what you're talking about because of their experiences, because they've gone to a drumming circle, to a naturopath, to a chiropractor, to an emotional healer, to an energy person, to a psychic. Whatever they've done, they've had multiple experiences that have helped them get a sense of who they are in a holistic way. One of my teachers calls it rainbow medicine. I like that phrase, that we should have, there's a spectrum of colors, of ways of approaching ourselves. Sometimes all of them are good, sometimes one, depending on the person in their moment of life. I think it's in a hologram, you know, those pictures that you have on your credit cards that have those multi-dimensionality to them. If you take a picture that's a regular, picture on a piece of paper, if it was glass, and you dropped it, and the elbow went flying to the left, and the hand went flying to the right, you'd have a picture of broken up into pieces all over the place. But if it's a holographic image, and you picked up any one of those broken pieces, you can see, however less clear, all the pieces of all the image. In the hand, you can see the elbow and the head. It's just less clear. That's what makes it holographic. In any one piece, all of the pieces really are there in that one piece. Dreams are like this also. So I think of what you're saying, that it's a holographic thing. If I send somebody to you, and I analyze their dream, I love to do dream analysis, and you analyze them, diagnose them, studied them with your own diagnostics through your own medicine, we ought to be able to, you and I ought to be able to talk to each other and see some, from our different lenses, some of the same pictures. I'm wishing, I'm hoping we would. I'm thinking a lot of times we would.
Right. It's always a fascinating field for me, and I think the human nature, human spirit, and the possibilities. I was just reflecting back to some information. I sent it out on my Facebook page yesterday, and it was research that the HeartMath Institute did. They had a number of people meditate on gratitude, and they actually were looking at DNA. There was some DNA. This was a proper study, and so I guess they have their little DNA culture somewhere in the lab, And as people meditated on gratitude, the DNA, which can be tightly wound up, which means it doesn't express as optimally as it could, unwound, relaxed, and was more efficient in its communications. It would switch on things that were health-promoting. Just from the frequency from these people staying in a place of gratitude in their hearts.
That's gorgeous.
It's so powerful, isn't it, when we learn how to just open, to share, to be accepted. You know, you were talking about the relationship you have with your clients where they feel accepted and they can relax and be and explore together, how powerful it is in changing us physically, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually.
It's amazing. Yeah, to not react and have a knee-jerk. You know, like if somebody comes to me, then I think my job is not to be like everybody else they know. Otherwise, why do they have to come to a professional, right?
Right.
My job is not to think, "Why, you're a jerk for being that way," or whatever. "Boy, you're intimidating. I don't like that." You know, in the real world, so to speak, outside my practice, I cannot like that person the way they treat me. But in my practice, so to speak, and hopefully I get that way in the rest of my life also. But in my practice, then I apply what you're saying, a certain kind of discipline. Maybe their DNA feels that, I'm thinking as we're talking. And the discipline is to say, huh, that person's intimidating. I wonder if they know that. I wonder if they're intimidated in their life. My curiosity comes up. I wonder if they need to be a little bit more strong in certain places and don't know how to be as big as they're sort of acting right now. So my curiosity comes up. And just that openness, I bet you that does affect the DNA. That person says, oh, my gosh, this person's not going to tell me something's, you know, to undo this. I remember a woman came to visit me once with her son because her son had gotten arrested. He was 12 because he spit at a bus driver. And he spit at a couple of teachers also, and he was getting in trouble for spitting. And people now, of course, were trying to get him not to spit. Well, that makes sense, right? It's not so good to spit at people, so we all get that. And she said, what do you think? I said, well, I have no idea. Let's talk to him. And I said, tell me about the bus driver. And the bus driver treated a black woman who walked onto the bus badly. And he spit at the bus driver. So I said to him, let's spit together. You know, so I created a little spot where we could spit and it wouldn't be nothing going to damage anything, so to speak. And we spit and we spit. And I said, now let's put words to it. Jerk, idiot, whatever. And eventually, this is how I learned that his story came out about the bus driver, and he was upset with this person. He had a sense of justice in him. He didn't know what to do with it. I've been spit at someone. Not a very useful approach. Right?
Better behaviors.
But a lot of other people sat there and did nothing. Was that better?
Yeah.
I don't know what is better. I'm not trying to defend the spitting, but I'm defending it in the sense of maybe if we put the right attitude on it, the DNA of his spitting, as it were, relaxes, and he now gets to say to that bus driver someday, I'm offended. Well, the people might sit down. I think he's a more likely person to stand up for people in the world than a lot of people I've met. I love this kid. He felt
David,
it, right?
David, before we complete the show, this is the very end, what is the best website for people to go to?
Oh, thanks for asking. Yeah. The website is talkingbacktodrphil.com. So it's talkingbacktodr, the abbreviation for doctor, talkingbacktodrphil.com. And there they can see... get access to the book. You can get it on Amazon also, but you can listen to radio shows or TV interviews or get blogs from or print articles that I've written.
Okay,
yeah,
well, this has been a delightful conversation, David. I wish you all the best, and I wish everyone can find a therapist like you to help them on their journey.
Thank you. Back at you. I can feel your healing qualities as well. Thank you.
Okay, bye, David, and bye to all of you. Thank you for listening. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You're listening to What Women Must Know with my guest today, David Bedrick. And remember, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.